Blog Talk Radio.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Blogger News on the Radio. My name is Simon Barrett, and I will be your host today. For the past 2.5 years, my wife Jen and I have been here on Blog Talk Radio discussing the Casey Anthony case. We were on the verge of hanging up our microphones and reclaiming Sundays. I was even contemplating picking up a new hobby. I've heard there's this thing called football, although feet don't seem to be involved and the ball isn't round, but yeah, oh, what the hell, it might be fun. Apparently, though, that is not to be. So we want to welcome all of our listeners to our new program, the Sunday Afternoon Murder Club. We'll be exploring murders old and new. The panel, however, remains the same. We have my wonderful and beautiful, caring and loving wife, Jen.
Oh my God. Oh my God. Oh,
I can tell right now. Jen, you
oh,
have
yeah.
chocolate, don't you, Jen?
I thought he was going to say Cobra.
Oh my God.
Hello, everyone.
Hi, Jen. Do you have all the chocolate? Is that why he's talking nice to you?
Yeah, I kept it from him. He can't have it.
He's got the goodies.
From the City of Angels, we have legal expert and the man currently living through Carmageddon, Manny Barling. Manny, good afternoon.
Yeah, well, good afternoon. They actually opened up the 405 freeway at 11:30 today and proved how quickly people can work when you have a gun at their head.
Wow. You know,
an otherwise lazy American worker with all the TV cameras on and all the stress performed admirably.
and of course, that kills my follow-up question. I was going to ask you if there was any truth in the rumor that the emergency broadcast system was offering 15-minute updates on the 405.
Oh, if Fox News, of course, they didn't hack the phone number for the DMV or the Highway Patrol, managed to do a two-hour special yesterday. Ash and I recorded, because we vote on these for the Emmys, and breezed through it laughing at all the trivial things they could find to talk about. But what was funny is that all the local neighbors are pretty bright people, so they rode their bicycles. They put on their jogging clothes. They did everything to show up to check out what was going on. And it got so bad, the police threatened to arrest them. And then they put out a notice anyone caught walking around that area would be arrested, which is pretty nervy, really.
Only in LA.
Well, of course.
From Orlando, Florida, we're joined by journalist Dave Neckel. Dave, welcome to the program.
Hello, Simon. Hello, everyone. Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And from up in New York State, we have the crime doctor himself, Denny Griffin. Denny.
Good afternoon. Good afternoon. This is the Casey Anthony withdrawal suffering crime doctor.
Crazy.
Casey who?
Yeah. And from Fort Lauderdale, Florida, we have bondsman and general troublemaker William Cobra Storbs. Cobra, good afternoon.
It's me.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody.
As always, our chat room is open, and we do invite people to ask their questions of us, but we also ask that you please be nice to each other as well. Okay, so shortly after midnight today, or would that be midnight yesterday, Casey Anthony walked out of jail a free woman. Jan, as I understand it, she left the jail with Jose Baez and jumped in a black SUV. Where did they go?
I don't know, but they said that, from what I understand, it was followed, and then as they went into a parking garage, and hasn't been seen since. So I don't know, but they did claim that there was somebody, the cops or somebody was escorting someone at the airport, but into a small jet. But they claim that the airport officials are saying that it was golfers that was on the plane, but who knows?
Dave, the story I heard was that the parking garage that the SUV headed for was the Bank of America building where, coincidentally, Cheney Mason has his office. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, yeah, that was the first report that it went into that garage. And that was my parking garage choice. So I know it pretty well. And it's on the backside of the building. And so you could park in the garage and you could walk out from into the back end of the building, and then you could either go out the front doors, or you know, on one side is the bank, and on the other side is the restaurant bar. But then there's different sets of elevators, and in the middle of the building are the ones that will take you up to the 22nd floor where Cheney Mason's office is. But at that time of night, there aren't going to be too many people milling around there. I think that once they got inside the building, they went up to Cheney Mason's office, did whatever they had to do, and then came out. And any parking garage in Orlando is going to be open at night. So they could have just easily gone to another vehicle and disappeared. I saw that video of the girl running to the jet, but I there's nothing that verifies that it was Casey, so I can't say that we know who that was, that she hopped on that jet or not, but I doubt if she's still in Orlando.
Okay.
Well, you know, there are rumors that she's headed to Beverly Hills to have a facelift, and there are all sorts of, you know, guys in Beverly Hills that love to do that for. I think too many of us watched the Humphrey Bogart classic Dark Passage, if you've ever seen the movie, where he escapes from San Quentin, gets plastic surgery, hides for a few months, and shows up looking like Humphrey Bogart. So maybe she's going to look like Humphrey Bogart in a few weeks.
Casey loves her own face too much. She's not going to change that.
There you go.
At her age, why should she?
And she's not going to, because she likes the way she looks.
Actually,
although,
Manny,
it was
me that started the rumor that she was headed for L.A. and she was going to be staying in your guest house.
Well, you know, well, listen, she'd be welcome. I mean, yeah, I'd get to interview her and write a little book and the whole rest. Why not?
Okay, on a more serious note, Denny,
yes.
Where can she go? You know, where can she go and lay low? In fact, will she lay low?
Well, that's the whole thing. I don't think she's going to be making a whole lot of money laying low. I think she's going to have to, if she's going to get these mega paydays for these interviews that people have been talking about, she's obviously going to have the mug on television and be out there. And I'm still not convinced. I know originally they said Springer offered her $1 million or something, but I'm not sure how accurate any of that stuff is and how much she's really going to be offered. But if she wants to make a lot of money, she's probably going to have to be out there unless she goes into seclusion somewhere and works on her book.
Well, let me offer some thoughts on you, because I have a lot of experience in this media area on those issues. The first thing they've tried to do is get her to take a few weeks to first of all, to make everybody calm down, and then it allows her agent to negotiate. And if nobody knows where they are and they can't press her, it's easier to sell her rights for an exclusive interview to a 60 Minutes, Fox News, or whatever. And in the end, it's going to be a big network because they're the ones who can afford to do it and afford her a wider market and will go to wherever she is, even if she's in hiding. So being in hiding and unavailable actually makes it easier for her people to negotiate. One of my closest friends, Tom Capper, the former president of Fox News and ABC News and the son of Frank Capper, the famous director, said to me yesterday basically that he was going to call around and see who was negotiating, but as far as he knew, everybody was negotiating, that everybody had been throwing numbers out, but not big numbers, 25,000, 50,000. So until someone comes into the market, and it's usually Fox, believe it or not, and starts offering large amounts of money to make everybody bid, then the bigger dollars come up. But until there's competition, more than one or two that want to do it, the numbers are going to be around $25,000 to $50,000.
Well, didn't they have that guy that was with Jerry Springer's show form his own company and offer her the $1 million?
Well, yeah, but, you know, most of those are PR. You know, you're the same way, I forgot who it was, came up with a big deal the other day about her doing a movie, and then there was the porno film. So everybody looks for a way to get some advertising out of it. So they're going to be people who release false news releases that ABC's negotiating with their agent for a $1 million deal when they probably aren't because they just want to get their name in the newspaper. So at some point, you have to look at a show's ratings, what their advertising budget is, and what they can do. And it'd be unlikely that Springer or anyone related to Springer could afford to put out $1 million for that short of an interview. Even if she gave a two-hour interview and they broke it up over a number of shows, the numbers wouldn't pan out. And the only numbers that will really pan out is for a CNN, a Fox, or a CBS, where they can use it on the news 60 Minutes and on the Sunday morning show. And so you need a wider exposure to recoup those kind of dollars because, you know, they're making a fortune on news, and if they budget that type of interview, it knocks out a lot of their profits.
Well, they were also talking about, ABC was talking about having Katie Couric be the first one to interview her as her debut with ABC, too. And I said, yeah, I guess she'll go up and ask Casey Anthony, how does it feel to be an American hero for beating the system again,
You know, Jan, I doubt the mouse will be involved. They're so concerned with image and family values, and I know too many people in the hierarchy at Disney, who we refer to in Los Angeles as the mouse, to know that they're concerned that, especially in Orlando where they have Disney World, that people could possibly boycott them for an interview. So I think they will probably be an unlikely suitor in this.
Manny.
Well, they didn't seem to mind it when they bought all those pictures and stuff from them. So, I don't know.
Well, that's different. That is, buying the pictures early in the game and syndicating the photos is a little different than having this high-profile murder where a family values TV show who fosters what Disney does suddenly want to interview and pay $1 million to someone who's the general public feels murdered their child. I think that's really inconsistent with what Disney stands for and something they're extraordinarily careful about. And that's why, Jan, I don't think they'll do it.
Cobra, where do you think she's going to be making her money?
On her back.
Isn't that how this all started?
You asked me. That's where she's going to end up making her money, on her back. That's probably where she's at right now. Shit.
Simon.
I hope she makes a bunch of money, and I hope Tim Miller gets it all. That's what I hope.
Okay, I heard Denny pipe up there. Denny,
yeah,
jump in.
I wanted to probably direct this to Manny, but I guess it's open to anybody, but Manny's got the experience here. Okay, if some big money starts coming out there, I'm talking, you know, the Foxes or the ABCs or whatever. Now, before they give out these seven figures or upper six-figure deals for her appearance or for her interview, they probably would want some ground rules, wouldn't they? I mean, they wouldn't want to just film her sitting in their studio. They'd want some type of a dialogue. And would that require her to do what? To tell the truth? I mean, what are they going to want, these networks offering, if and when they offer the big money? in return for her appearance? What are they going to expect from her?
Well, Denny, that's why my initial instincts are that this is not a seven-figure interview. It's not Bobby Blake. It's not O.J. Simpson with a celebrity with some media following and a background and a history. So what other interest does she command other than this trial? And then you have to ask yourself, who wants to hear from her? And then you have to take a look at what she was going to say. So usually when you do this type of agreement, there's a preliminary interview, and then they take a look at it. So the initial agreement is dependent in some part upon what the initial interview is and what they feel they're going to get from them. Because believe me, the networks have paid for interviews that have been so bad they haven't been able to really use them, and then they've had to eat the amount of money. So no one's going to put out a seven-figure interview fee without some realization they're going to get something hot that's going to get huge ratings. Because when you pay $1 million for that kind of interview, number one, you're going to criticize the media. You're going to get criticized by the other media. You're going to get criticized by the people who go, why are you paying this girl $7 million who murdered her child? So you have to have a level of sensationalism that trumps all the negatives. So you're right, Danny. Unless she's got something really great to say that the network feels is going to get the maximum ratings, they can't justify spending the money.
Well, you know, nobody wants to hear that the child drowned. Nobody wants to hear that she was molested, because nobody believes that. And if they go on there and that's all that she's going to say, nobody wants to hear that, period. I mean, everybody wants to know what happened to Kaylee.
Well,
and
I agree,
who can say we can't? I mean, who can believe what Casey says? Nobody can believe a word she says anymore.
Well, it's not only that, Jan, but what has she got to say, as you say, of interest? We know what her defense is. If she's going to simply parrot Jose Baez's opening statement, why would anybody pay $1 million for that?
That's what I'm saying. And if that's all she's going to say,
they could get Baez to say it for $25,000, right?
Yeah, but like I said, nobody wants to hear it. So what? Why would they pay money to begin with to have her say something that he said in court that everybody's already heard and blew off already?
And for that reason, I don't think she could write a book that would be a big seller. I think if Dave Neckel wrote a book or another columnist in the area about following the trial all the way through and had something worth saying, that would outsell any I survived the jury type of book.
I agree. Because,
first of all, it would have to be ghostwritten by somebody, and that immediately takes some of the sting off. So what are you going to do? Hire Dave, you know this happens all the time where writers, especially in sports, most famous sports figures don't write their own biographies. They have a ghostwriter or they have a co-author. So at the end of the day, I come back to Jan's point. What does this girl have to say that would cause any of us to go, I can't wait to get home tonight and watch Casey Anthony be interviewed? I can't think of anything. Can anyone else on the panel think of anything?
Well, let's get Dave's reaction.
Dave, are you there?
I know he's there. He's just hiding.
Maybe he's on the phone with Casey Anthony offering her seven-figure numbers. And if you look at the media, in a down media where books aren't selling well, newspapers aren't selling well, you wonder which newspaper, other than a Wall Street Journal or someone like that, they don't have the readership to support a large payment. And right now they have their own worries, don't they?
Right, and you know, a newspaper is not going to go for it. The numbers don't work.
Right.
That they don't have the advertising, they don't have the clout. Only a major network could go for it. I mean, Manny, you've summed it up so well. Not only is there an interview component, but it has to be something that you can hammer on your news broadcasts. And, you know, a newspaper can't do that.
I agree. And I think we've all seen this before. startling revelations, ABC being interviewed, and there's always that hint that you're going to hear something no one ever heard at the trial or some juicy piece of thing nobody's ever heard. Well, what is Casey Anthony going to say? And by the way, I've not seen her really speak on an informal basis, nor have really any of you except maybe Cobra. So we don't even know whether she could communicate well with people. What if she's got a, what if her education is so poor, she's so poorly spoken, that an interview with her is like, well, and who wants to have somebody interview somebody who sounds like an 18-year-old, basically illiterate? So that is a problem also.
Simon?
Yes.
I just wanted to comment. Manny raises a good point, and regarding a ghostwriter or co-author. Now, I've co-authored some mob biographies, and I want to tell you something. Certain places have put those books to the test. I mean, every claim that was made had to be accounted for. So these books were gone over, and the Frank Collada book was, in fact, going to be used in the Operation Family Secrets trial. And we had the defense and the prosecution both going over the manuscript and stuff. So I would be very hesitant to want to get involved as a ghostwriter or co-author for a Casey Anthony book, because I wouldn't want to put my reputation on the line or my credibility on the line. And you'd virtually have to, almost everything you put in the book would have to be something where it couldn't be disproved. In other words, you know, well, Lee and I were alone in the house and he tried to grope me. Or, he said, she said, because if you get anything out there that can be actually where there could be other witnesses or documentation or whatever to the claim, oh, my God, I just couldn't imagine going through that and being ripped to shreds. And you know that people would, the anti-Casey Anthony forces would be out there. And any claim that you make in that book that can't be substantiated, you're in for a world of hurt. So I, as a writer, I would not want to get involved in that kind of a project at all.
I'd also like to point out to listeners who may not know this, Denny wrote an autobiography of Frank Collada, and the book was meticulously researched, and guess what happened? An almost three-decade-old double homicide was solved by Denny's book. Denny, do you want to tell us the Shaft story real quick?
Yeah, there was a 1981 murder in Lakemore, Illinois, about 40 miles, I believe, out of Chicago. And it was a cold case. I didn't realize. I thought it had been solved because Frank Collada, when he turned government witness in 1982, had told the Lakemore police and prosecutor the story that Frank's associate, a guy by the name of Larry Newman, had done the killing. Well, as it turned out, they hadn't acted on the information, and when the book came out in 2007, it was still a cold case. And the Sharf's son, Paul Sharf, happened to read the book, and we ended up, Frank, then they contacted the Lakemore police, and they contacted me, and I put him in touch with Frank, and a former FBI agent who had been involved in this thing back in 82, and they finally determined that Larry Newman was, in fact, the murderer. So it was quite a thing, but yes, it was, and the Sharf, Paul Sharf and his family were certainly grateful that after, I think at the time it was 26 years or whatever, the deaths of Ron Sharf, Paul's father, and Patricia Freeman, his barmaid, in his bar in Lakemore, were finally solved.
Right, but I mean, the point is, you did a lot of research. You know, it's not like you invented some BS And
yes.
And I think that's your whole point, you know, to ghostwrite something for Casey Anthony would be a quagmire.
Oh God, well, I couldn't imagine it.
Danny, let's
expand
on
yet?
Yeah. Let's expand on that for a moment, Danny. One of the reasons, and it's more true, I think, in Casey Anthony case than others I've watched, there are a lot of collateral players and peripheral people who've been defamed in some way, who are very sensitive. And for that book to get clearance from a publisher's lawyers, knowing there are so many people collateral to this case whose names could and would be mentioned in this book, who may have rights because they're private citizens and they're not subject to some of the protections that people who are, that doesn't give the media the protection of writing about a Charlie Sheen or someone who's in the public eye, is subject to a lot of defamation lawsuits. So they have to be extraordinarily cautious. So they will limit the parameters of that book by their concerns about prospective liability, which again limits the book.
Can you hear me yet?
Yeah, go ahead.
There you
go. Oh, no, I just want to know whether you can hear me or not. No, I know exactly what you're talking about, because even writing for the magazine, the editor said some things about, well, maybe we shouldn't put that in because of legal reasons.
Yeah, I agree. And in the case of Casey Anthony, almost everybody involved in that is not a public figure. Every one of them are entitled
right.
to certain types of privacies.
But I think one of the things that takes away from a book now is the fact that this whole thing was so anticlimactic. You know, there was no happy ending. There was no surprise ending, yes, but it wasn't a surprise that people expected. So I don't know, where do you end a book like that?
Well, it's not only end it. What do you have to say that hasn't been said before? And, Dave, I don't
yeah,
know if you
yeah.
could... you could hear my comment that if she's just going to parrot Jose Baez's opening statement, they might as well just pay Jose $25 to show up and say it himself. You know, I mean, why do they need her to parrot what Jose Baez has been saying? Why pay her seven figures to say something everyone's already heard and is disgusted with? So what would be new about this case that people don't know other than, yeah, I killed her, and this is how I killed her, and this is what I did?
Well, there are things. I mean, but the thing is, like, the person who would be my editor said that you're going to have to give up some goods. You're going to have to give up some of those people that you would talk to and everything. And there are people that are willing to help me with a book and everything, but they want to remain, anonymous. And these
right.
are, like, high-level people, some of them, you know?
Yeah.
And that's where the excitement would come in, would be like, oh, so Dave did talk to this person or did have a relationship of some kind with that person or whatever. And that's the kind of stuff that I'm not really, once I give somebody my word, I don't care about being a reporter, journalist, whatever, or just an ordinary person. When I give you my word, I'm not really going to sit there and publicize it in the future, to sell a book.
Right. And by the way, that's what lawyers face. I represented a couple of professional teams. In one case, I was involved in a very high-profile issue involving a very famous athlete, and everything I saw reported was incorrect, and my friends in the media, and some of them write for AP, and most of them are announcers on local TV stations and national TV, kept saying, come on, you represent the team, give me an exclusive or whatever. But everything I wanted to say to them, I couldn't say to them, and I obviously couldn't give them a source, although they would guess it was my client, it was a team owner. And it just placed me in such a compromising situation. For about a year, I would go to parties and dinner parties and birthdays, and my friends would look at me and I'd go, nope, I can't do it. Don't ask me, and because that's what you go through, right, Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, people want to ask you, and you just can't say anything because you can't take the risk of exposing someone to later criticism.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Let's move on a little bit. Casey, maybe, skipping down the street with Janie Mason on one hand and Jose Baez on the other, but she still has some issues. Kudos to Manny. You called this last week on the program. You said the Zenny, the Nanny deposition set for the 19th was just a not-happening event. But it didn't happen for the reason that you said. On Friday, there was an emergency hearing, and the judge recused himself from the case. Dave, you're closest to Ground Zero. Do you have any clue what the hell went on?
No, none whatsoever. And no one in the legal community, maybe Manny does, but I have no idea why that judge recused himself. None whatsoever.
Well,
it wasn't because of any involvement with me. I can say that for sure.
Oh, sure, Dave, right. Is he having a beer waiting for you?
Yeah.
Well, and first of all, whether or not the judge recuses himself, it has no bearing on whether or not the deposition goes forward, unless there were a pending motion to compel her to a deposition and there's no judge who can order her. But as I understand that depo, it was still in the notice phase and was not subject to court order. So if it's not subject to court order, she's still bound to appear for that depo, and she's still not going to. What will happen is the other side will make a motion to compel and for sanctions, for a court order compelling her to appear, and then there has to be a judge in place. But usually recusal is followed within a day or two of a replacement judge. When you recuse a judge, you file what's called a 170.6. Sometimes that number changes in jurisdiction. And the judge does it. He sends the file to the presiding judge with his recusal. And the presiding judge looks around and goes, okay, who do I want to send this to? And he looks for people who don't have conflicts of interest. And then he looks for a judge who's strong enough to handle this kind of nonsense that goes with these high-profile cases. So it's oddly enough a chance for the presiding judge to pick one of his better judges to hear the case. So you're talking about a day or two delay at the most.
I think what they did, though, that afternoon, I think they'd set another date for it. I believe it's set now for in October.
What,
unless
the deposition?
Unless I read it wrong, yeah.
Well, that's
I don't remember where I read it at, but I think they did.
And that's what I expected to happen. And there's
right.
No way you're going to get someone fresh out of jail on Sunday to appear,
no.
You know, a couple of days later.
No, what they were trying to do was trying to get her to get it, if they couldn't get it set, ordered for her to appear Tuesday, they were going to try to get it done in jail while she was still in jail.
No, they would have had a better luck getting it done in jail than they would have
that's
were they're
out
they
on were
the street.
That's what they were going to try to do whenever they went into the court. I mean, and then that's when the judge recused himself. He said that, I mean, that's what they were planning on doing. Well, that's what I read. That's the way I understood it anyway, that
well,
that's what they were trying
out.
To do.
Yeah. And by the way, I don't know why they would want to do that. Any lawyer who's taken depositions in jail, and believe it or not, not that many lawyers do. It is just a horrible experience. It's just terrible. You're in this stinky, dirty room, and if you've got, and the one time I had to do it on that kind of an issue, there were 9 lawyers cramped into this awful room. We had to go through 4 levels of doors, and anyone who's ever done a tour of the jail, when you hear that door clank behind you, it makes your stomach turn about the 4th one, and you wonder how these people don't go nuts every day. So here you are locked in the middle of nowhere, and you can't walk out the door and light a cigarette if you're a smoker. You can't go, gee, I'd like some fresh air, because you got to go 3 or 4 guards out to get out, and once you're out, they don't want to let you back in. So
that's a non-smoking facility, by the way.
They all are
yeah.
now. So at the
yeah.
end of the day, lawyers experience a similar form of confinement as the inmates. So the only time it ever works well is I've taken a few at Club Fed, which is the federal prison of Lombok, which looks better than some of the local country clubs here. And there it's a light, breezy, and, you know, nice area. And then it's an easy deposition. But also you also have to travel to the jails. In this case, she was jailed locally. But in my case, the Lombok facility is above Santa Barbara. So it's about 90 miles from my house, 95 to 100. So you get it in the morning, drive 100 miles for deposition. And then if you have to sleep over in the city, it's not fun where most jails are located. And then you got to drive back. So most lawyers don't look forward to it. So in many respects, they'd probably wait till October because their case isn't going to get any better between the middle of July and October.
Well, okay, so it seems to me that the Zanny the Nanny lawsuit is pretty much a done deal for several months. A legal question for you, though, Manny. Zanny's claiming defamation, does she have a leg to stand on?
Well, I didn't hear everything that was said about her, and if in fact it's untrue, of course she has a rights of defamation. The test of defamation is whether the statement was true, and then the question of damages goes to the level of malice and other things involved. So they're, you know, basically speaking, in these situations, I'd say, of course she has a good lawsuit, but
Manny,
the only money she could ever recover would be if Casey Anthony had money.
Manny.
Yeah, go ahead, Dave. Yeah.
Here's the deal. Her name is Zenaida Gonzalez. I think there might even be a discrepancy in the Z and the S at the end, where the two names are spelled differently. In the lawsuit, her name is not Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez. In the lawsuit, she signs her name Zenaida Fernandez Gonzalez, and that's not her name. So I think there's a problem right there from the start. That Morgan filed, you know, I know everybody wants, you know, everything taken from Casey, and I understand that. But the problem is, you know, does this woman merit, does she really deserve that money?
Go ahead.
She didn't ruin her life for 3 years. You know, there's nothing that says, okay, in the meantime, let's put this on hold until she gets out of jail. Meanwhile, you go try and find yourself a job. Instead, it's been like one of those things, well, she ruined my life.
Well, yeah. The real issue is, did she ever use the term Zanny the Nanny?
No.
Well, then, to me, then she doesn't get anywhere anyway. So if that weren't her so-called name that she used or wasn't known by, how could she possibly claim that she was defamed by a name that she wasn't used? I mean, if she were going around saying, hire Zanny the Nanny, I'm a great nanny, and she were using that name for a couple of years, and that were, shall we say, her trade name, even though it weren't registered, should have a valid lawsuit. But, you know, if you're saying it's similar, then it doesn't work.
And at that time, I looked up, this is very early into the case, I looked up, I think I found about a dozen Zenaida Gonzalez's in the Orlando area. Orlando, Kissimmee, you know, the overall Orlando area, metropolitan area.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not such an uncommon name. I'll bet you'd find at least that many in Los Angeles.
But
But
they're claiming that Casey gave the name, the color car she had or the kind of car or something about the tag or something about her car, about how many kids she had. And, I mean, there was a few more details about it besides just her name.
Well, she didn't have six kids like this one does.
There's something about that Casey got from that Sawgrass apartment from the manager's office.
Well, Jan, was any of this published or Dave? So in other words,
I read it online. I don't remember where I read it, but I read about it.
Here's the problem with the she gave the story, I guess, and the next day is when Zanny went to Sawgrass. In other words, Casey's story about Sawgrass was made up before that Zanny went there. And then it just so happened that Zenaida Gonzalez was looking for apartments in that area. It wasn't the only apartment complex she visited that day. So was it strictly, it just happens that. I can understand that would be an issue, but if you look at the timeline, it doesn't really make sense. And now how she got the car or whatever, I don't know, did that Zanny really have a New York license plate? Like Casey Zanny did. You know, there are some things that have probably grown wings and stories have flown off, you know, because of it. I guess I'd have to get right back to the very beginning of it and go over it again.
You know, Dave, I can hear the toilet in the background warming up to flush this case because so far I haven't heard one thing that gives her a legal right to assert this kind of cause of action. If you, when it comes to defamation, it has to be very, very specific. There are a lot of cases where people say, my group was defamed. You know, you said something about, well, you could even use gays as an example, so therefore I'm gay. So your insult to all the gays in the world is a personal insult. You've defamed me personally. Those cases don't work. They have to be specific. You have to be able to recognize the name. You have to be able to get enough to identify it to know that the person is, this individual person is being held in disrepute, and everybody has to know it's this particular person. If you have to guess, or you have to summarize, or you have to start using paper clips and staple guns to connect the parts, it doesn't work. And that's
well,
what
I wonder if that's why it keeps getting postponed, because it's not important.
The court case got lost before it got started in Baez's opening statement. You know, oh, yeah, the Zanny the Nanny, just another of, you know, Casey's many fictitious friends. Denny, do you think the Zanny suit stands any chance at all of success?
Well, tell you the truth, Simon, I haven't read the suit and exactly what the allegation is. So there might be something in there based on you know what Dave and Manny are saying. If that's all there is to it, then probably not.
Well, let's go. Wait a minute, and I want to add something, Danny. You're familiar with the litigation privilege in throughout the states. That whatever you say during the course of a lawsuit is not actionable in defamation. So if you show up in court and you say something uncharitable about something, buddy, you cannot sue them. They can't be sued. So whatever Baez said in his opening statement is not actionable. Because if you did that and allowed that, it would basically put what they call a cold freeze on the truth and facts, and it would prevent people from making statements in open court. And that's one of the problems in this world. When people sue other people, they get away with saying whatever they want and accusing them of whatever they want. And it's very, very hard to retaliate unless you can prove that lawsuit it was malicious. And then what you have is a malicious prosecution action, not a defamation action.
Well, I'd like to throw two things out and get comments. Okay, I know Simon, unless Simon wants to cut this and move on to something else, but two things that just came to my mind. One thing is even if the lawsuit itself ends up getting thrown out, is what they could possibly gain for other projects, such as a book or whatever, through the discovery process of getting Casey deposed and other people in it. Would that be something that would be a worthwhile project and a reason to go through discovery, even if it's thrown out later, is to get the depots of a lot of the key players on this? The other thing would it be any remote possibility if Casey suddenly says, holy mackerel, you know, I was thinking in my head of all these millions of dollars rolling in for books and interview stuff, but, you know, I don't have much in the way of credibility, and the fact that Baez, you know, already let the cat out of the bag about the drowning. So maybe I should go back and basically throw Baez under the bus, or not really throw him under the bus, but say, hey, look, that was all bullshit, what I told Jose. There was no drowning, you know, and for $1 million, ABC or Fox News or whatever, I'll get on your show, or I'll write this book, you know, Mr. Publisher, and I'll tell the true story of what happened to Caitlin. Exclusive. Is there any remote chance that she could try that to say, okay, look, I need something to sell the network. I need something to sell to a book publisher. I can't do much about my credibility. It is what it is. But I could change the story from what Baez said in opening and go to some other scenario of how Kaylee actually died. So are either of those two options out there?
Well, first of all, you know, saying that about a Baez might even make him more famous, because if he came up with a bullshit line in this country that worked, that would probably make him a hero, right?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, saying that my lawyer was bullshitting in court and I won, we'll probably get a lot of people who want to hire a bullshitter in court who can make him win. So I don't know if that would hurt him. You know, as far as the other, you know, networks are pretty sophisticated. If you don't have the meat, you're not going to get the money. And they're not going to do this pie in the sky. I'm not going to say till we get on the network before I say it. They're not going to release the kind of funds they want. So there's going to be some method of proving and knowing what she's going to say. Plus, of course, a lot of these are pre-recorded. They're not done live because they want to be able to promo them with highlights. So they know well in advance whether they're getting screwed or not. So I don't see any network releasing money or doing anything that would allow Casey Anthony to pull the wool over anyone's eyes. She's a 23 now.
25.
Oh, she's 25 now? Wow, how time passes. So here we got this 25-year-old girl with a limited education, not the swiftest pencil in the deck, who has to hire an agent who's going to try and fool CBS, NBC, Fox, and CNN. Good luck. So how are you going to do that?
Okay.
Annie, would the pre-interview that a network would want to do with Casey so they could critique it basically and research it and see what facts need to be verified, would that be kind of akin to a proffer?
Oh, absolutely. It would be what would be equivalent to a proffer, which is a proffer in the legal business is where you offer a set of facts, almost like an opening argument to a judge or somebody, to form the basis of what you're going to do later or prove, and decisions are made on it. In the media business, a proffer usually comes with backup evidence and other things for people to pursue them. So in other words, they basically vent the other people involved. They want to know, for example, I wouldn't go on the air for the media without knowing who she was going to mention in there. What if she mentioned Zanny the Nanny again by name, saying, you know, that bitch, you know, she sued me. She was really probably responsible. But anyway, whether she said that or put it in a book, no publisher and no network's going to accept that kind of statement without plenty of knowledge in advance and vetting it to make sure it were true. So would you put someone on like her and take that kind of risk of being sued for defamation without knowing what she's going to say? I don't think so.
That's an interesting point, Manny.
Yeah, I mean,
okay.
You know, no ticky, no shirty, right, guys? You don't write checks to people and you don't know what you're getting.
Yes.
Okay, I want to move on to another lawsuit that was filed recently. Tim Miller of Texas Equisearch is trying to extract $115,000 for you know, wasted time, wasted resources. Does he stand any chance of prevailing? Dave.
Well, first of all, where was the lawsuit filed, Simon? Do you know where it was filed, Texas or Florida or what?
I think it was in Florida, I think.
I think it was. I can't say for sure, but I think it was.
Okay. Well, because there's two sets of laws in California, one for Texas and one for the rest of the union. So I always like to know whether it's in Texas because you never know what's going to happen there.
Okay. We'll just gloss over that part.
Why? Every lawyer in the United States, this is the home of the Saw Red Doctrine, a state that said if a man shot his wife and said, I caught her with another man, I was so upset I saw red, that they find you not guilty for murder. So Texas has a long line of bizarre laws and bizarre legal interpretations. So believe me, you'll find that in law books and you'll find that among lawyers dealing with Texas law. And one day if you want to do a show on Texas law, I'll tell my 10 favorite Texas law stories and I'll have you howling. So go ahead.
Okay. I'm going to go back to my original question. Texas Equisearch has all sorts of really, really great tools. They have side scan, radar, That they have horses, they have 4x4 vehicles, and what I'm hearing about this lawsuit is
it was filed in Orange County, by the way.
Oh, it was.
Yeah, I just looked it up.
Yeah, it has to be filed in the county where the defendant resides. That's rule number one. So it had to be in Orange County.
Right. So, you know, we have this lawsuit, and I haven't, you know, thumbed through every page of it, but the précis that I'm being told is that he's suing on behalf of his organization because their time was wasted. They were looking for a live Kaylee Anthony. Now, you don't use side scan radar to look for dead ones. Do you?
Well, no, but I don't think you look in the wilderness with side scan radar for live people when they're that young. So, assuming that she were left in the wilderness alive at her age, how long would she live? So, I mean, it's absolutely absurd after a week or two for someone to tell me they're looking out in that kind of wilderness and forest for a two-year-old, especially in a state full of alligators and other predators. It's just absurd. But let's hit the real basic line. The question is, you have to have a legal right to sue. And the first question is, do you have a contract which creates what we call privity? Privity is almost like, you know, someone holding hands and having some relationship that touch each other, a nexus, a touching that allows you to sue them. And that's usually the basis of all written contracts, right? The parties of the contract sue. If not, you sue in tort, which is a harmful wrong to another. Well, you know, basically, what are you going to sue for? Her being negligent? Well, I don't think she was negligent. She was intentional. So since she was intentional, that bulls that up. So if it's intentional conduct, how does that relate to a company in Texas? How did she intentionally do an act that were contemplated by a company in Texas that she contemplated would injure them? And I know of no legal right that allows them to sue other than to gain some publicity and, of course, to harass her and blow off some anger. But unless Florida has some unique law that allows a civil action arising out of a false police report, I really don't know how. And, as I said earlier, when you file something with the police, it's privilege. So if she reported that child missing and alive on a 911 call or to police officers and the search started, that's a privileged communication with a law enforcement agency. So unless someone can show me some new issue, and I'll research that between now and next week, I can't think of any basis whatsoever for them to be able to sue her. Does anyone else have any basis?
Well, I have to admit, Manny, for once, I'm in total agreement with you.
Oh, my God. Mark this down, Jan.
Okay, I got it.
The next thing you'll know, he'll agree with Cobra, and that'll really ruin your reputation, Simon.
Dave, do you think that Tim Miller's lawsuit has any merit?
Well, you know, after listening to Manny, I questioned that. I mean, I think that in my spirit, I think that he deserves it. Yes, absolutely. This Houston newspaper that I found online, it's actually, it's called the Chronicle, Houston and Texas News, that he spent more than $100,000 in motel rooms,
yeah,
rented vehicles, and other expenses that consumed 40% of the organization's annual budget. And I wonder, you know, that's okay. Now, if he legally can't get money back, I mean, God, I wish there was something morally, that could be done. But, you know, I mean, there were other, let's say that someone else died because they couldn't search and help another family somewhere else because of this. I mean, I don't know. I mean, to me, it's immoral what Casey did.
Well,
but
we all agree with that. The question that
yeah.
becomes the other one. Well, let me ask you a really interesting question. a question for everybody is they made a business decision to do this. It was their business decision. She didn't call them up and personally ask
them to
do it. And she didn't do it, but this is what they do. So they made a business decision. It didn't work out, and they lost money. And people make business decisions every day, and they lose money. What about other searches they made where they didn't find somebody, where there may not have been a great a good decision? Well, how about the one that Simon sent me, the Zara Baker case? And by the way, I have to comment as a brief aside, when I saw the stepmother, Eliza Baker, had been married seven times and sometimes didn't even bother to get a divorce, and made me reminded me that Casey Anthony is quite, if she, this woman can find a husband, especially after seeing that mean-spirited photo of her. She looked like Gary Busey in drag. And the bottom line is, how many people will marry Casey Anthony? And I guess there's a fool out there for everyone. But the point is, this isn't the only time Equifax has failed, and other people have failed searching for other one. And there have been a lot of reasons, and most of them are blamed upon the criminal participants. They searched for Zara Baker and couldn't find her. Does that mean they're going to sue her, too? Because in every search, there's a certain amount of error.
Well, the thing is now, I think he's suing the wrong person. I think he should go after Cindy Anthony, because Cindy Anthony is the one that argued with him and told him she did not want him looking for a dead Kaylee. She wanted him to look for a live one. She told him that.
But here, Manny, here's an interesting point that Snoopy made on one of the comments in the chat room, that Tim Miller, that's why there was a real problem between Cindy and Tim Miller, because Tim Miller came and then he said, well, look, I'm searching for a dead Kaylee. So that was when Cindy wanted nothing more to do with
him. She threw a fit
about
it. So
really, did he come in there searching for a live Kaylee or a dead one? You see, then that changes the whole outlook on this lawsuit. If you get Tim Miller...
It goes back to my original comment. What rational person, when a baby 2 years old is missing for 2 days, supposedly in the wilderness, they're either kidnapped and alive, and you don't need side radar to drive down through apartment buildings to figure out who kidnapped her. It won't do any good. So it's only good for searching in the wilderness. And if you've got a two-year-old in the wilderness who's been missing, 4 months by then, or even a week, you got to assume that child is dead, because I've never seen a two-year-old that could really survive, especially, first of all, how about no water for 2 days? The average human can't last longer than 3 days without water. I don't think a two-year-old child could live more than a day and a half because their bodies are so vulnerable. So any educated American would have to assume that child is dead. It's either kidnapped and being held for ransom, or it's dead. So he has to make his own decisions in his business, and for him now to say I was influenced by Cindy or anyone else to make my decision, I'm sorry, but either he's a fool or a bad businessman.
Okay, Denny, I'd like you to weigh in. Do you think that there is any chance of Tim Miller prevailing in this lawsuit?
Well, first, I just had seen something, that he filed, but my understanding was, and I haven't looked at anything online regarding the actual paperwork, but I thought I had heard before that he was going to sue not just Casey, he was going to go after Cindy and George as well. I don't know if he did, but that was my understanding from a few days ago when there was speculation that he was going to sue. And that he said Equisearch didn't seek to get involved in this case. They were invited in,
or called in
by Cindy.
Right.
Cindy and George. So,
It's just against Casey.
Pardon me?
It's just against Casey. I'm looking at it right now.
Oh, well,
no, but originally that's what they had said. And I know Cindy and George Cindy is the one that called them in to begin with.
Even if she invited them in, okay, it really doesn't change the relationship unless she signs some agreement. Where does she say that she's going to be, responsible if they can't find it? Where does she say that she's willing to underwrite any particular cost? what agreement or what expectation does anybody have when that happens? Really, to me, none. I mean, does that mean that if you invite CBS News to cover a story that you're liable if you've lied to them? Dave, I mean, how would you sue somebody if they gave you false information for a newspaper article?
Well, I don't know. You know, you're making, you know, certainly you're a lawyer. You make all these valid points. But it would be nice, I think, if Miller could get something back. But you know, you do kind of, the way you explained it, I understand why. You know, yeah, he's an adult. He's responsible for what he did. He did acknowledge that he came in and then was looking for a dead child. So I guess I'll have to read his lawsuit. But I mean, does he mention in his lawsuit that this is because Casey knew all along that the child was dead and hidden somewhere, and she lied throughout that whole process about that. Then when Texas EchoSearch went looking for a dead person, Casey knew all along where the child was located.
Well, I have a question.
So they wasted all that time and money.
Dave, I have a question for everybody on the panel. Have any of you ever seen anybody sued for lying to somebody else and get damages?
No.
Yeah, I haven't either. Believe me, I wish that right were there. In a country where they're trying to close the floodgates of litigation, as the conservatives like to say, this would open it up because of, forget about Casey Anthony, there are just as many other people around the country, there would probably be 10,000 new lawsuits over some variation of this issue. And I don't think any legislature has ever contemplated this or discussed this as an alternative.
Okay, I'm going to do a quick straw poll here. We have talked about two civil suits, Zenaida Gonzalez and Tim Miller. Jan, do you think either of them have a cat in hell's chance of being successful?
Does I'd like to see them. I'll put it
all
like
right.
That.
It's not about moral values. It's about, you know, the word of law.
They're going to have a hard time with the word of law. I hate to admit that, but yeah, they will have a hard time with that unless they get lucky.
And Denny, do you see any chance whatsoever of either of those suits being successful?
Well, from what I've heard this afternoon here, probably slim to none. But, you know, I'm just thinking about Tim Miller's suit. Probably from a PR perspective, it might be a popular thing at the moment in the climate of today to sue Casey Anthony, and that might help out EchoSearch on their, fundraising or donations and that type of thing. So maybe even if this lawsuit doesn't go anywhere, it might have been a wise move to do it.
Yeah, from a PR standpoint, I think I'm in agreement with you, but I don't see Tim Miller prevailing. Dave, do you see any of these lawsuits as going anywhere?
No, not really. Zenaida, I clearly understand why she doesn't deserve anything, because, I mean, she could have gone back to work. I mean, there's a lot of things that, you know, that I believe John Morgan was interested in. He used her as his stepping stone, you know, to put Casey on the stand. But, you know, the way Manny explains this with Texas EchoSearch and all, yeah, I understand where he's coming from. The problem that I'm seeing, though, is if it is to make money, if it is a publicity, and I don't want to say stunt, because I don't see that in that organization. I've got a lot of respect for them. But do these people have free attorneys everywhere they go? Every time they turn around and do something, some attorney is representing them. And, I mean, where does that end? And Texas EchoSearch has to start paying money to these attorneys that help them in civil litigations. I mean, that's a problem that I see now. In the end, how much money can they get out of this? This is a gamble if it is strictly for the donations. And how much is this attorney that's representing them going to make?
Well,
it's not free to file charges and stuff either, is it?
No, and first of all, to explain corporate law, Corporations have in-house counsel handle business and other affairs. Sometimes they have in-house defense lawyers, particularly large companies that deal with personal injury, automobile accidents, etc. But they rarely are out of their own jurisdiction, so a Texas company would not likely have a litigator on staff in Florida because they probably don't do much business in Florida, if at all. So, yes, they're paying lawyers, but the cost of filing this complaint is not a huge amount of money. Certainly, it's cheaper than one ad. So maybe they made a decision to file this lawsuit to publicize this issue, to make it a national issue that others can respond to in hope of fostering some legislation. So they may have some altruistic goals besides, trying to basically express their own emotions and feelings about it. And they may suggest that a law be passed, and they'll first start in Texas, not unlike the other Casey Anthony laws that have been suggested about reporting lost children, that somebody willfully lies and causes this kind of loss to a company that in the general public would have to pay damages. But she isn't going to be able to. And very quickly, procedurally, the first thing filed in the lawsuit is called a demur. In Latin, it means so be it. So basically what they were saying is, you filed a lawsuit against me, no matter what is contained in a lawsuit, there's no legal grounds, and the judge will look at it, weigh its legal sufficiency, and determine whether there are any legal theories upon which they could possibly recover. And if they can't think of one, then the judge will throw it out early. So this lawsuit may not survive the first filing in the court, and that's when you are going to find out, and I am going to find out, whether there's any basis of law for the case to proceed, because that's when the decision is made.
And I want to kill this discussion. I am going to mention that there is one more suit that's being filed, and I do not wish to discuss it. Apparently, Roy Kronk is suing Leonard Padilla. I mean, where the hell that's going to go, I don't know. Okay, now, also late last week, Baez and his team filed an appeal against the four misdemeanor charges that Casey Anthony was found guilty on, the lying to the cops. It, obviously, he cannot possibly remove the jail time. It's already been served. It has to be about the $4,000 fine. But I mean, what chance does he have of success? Dave, any thoughts?
Well, I don't know. Manny could either set me straight, agree with me or not. I mean, I would take his word over mine, in other words. But, I wonder if they file this because they can put everything else on hold. In other words, as long as appeal is going through. Thank you. Is going through. That's going to like put the screws on John Morgan. And even if Casey is forced to take that deposition that day, she can cry the Fifth Amendment all the time, all day long, because she's appealing. So I mean, she doesn't have to open her mouth. Is that true, Manny?
Yeah, I agree with that. I also agree. Something that hasn't come up is back to our Equifax lawsuit. If that's appealed and the judgment isn't final and she's not determined finally to have committed that crime, then even his lawsuit doesn't have any merit, does it? Because until there's a final order of the court, she's not guilty of lying. So
there
you
go. Yeah.
So there are a lot of areas that I see it freezing, and it buys time for them. I don't know what the appeal date is in Florida, but in California it's within 60 days. So he may have felt that the quicker he filed it, the better off he was. And so I see a lot of tactical reasons, including indecision. So he probably decided, because a notice of appeal is really only a two-page document, and your clerk can do it for you. So he might have decided to just do it and figure it out later. So he's not even sure why he filed it, more than likely.
Denny, wow. any thoughts on this appeal?
Yeah, there's probably a more strategy thing involved in it somewhere, I would assume.
Okay, I've absolutely had enough of Casey Anthony. I mean, quite honestly, if I never hear a name again, it will be too soon. I think she's a terrible person and has done terrible things. But yeah, that's just my personal thoughts. I want to quickly touch on another story. It hasn't received nearly as much press as Casey Anthony, and it involves a little Australian girl, Zara Baker. She managed to survive cancer. She lost a leg in the process, and apparently, well, not apparently, she certainly has lost her life. And the most likely culprit is the evil stepmother. Jen, do you want to give us the thumbnail sketch?
Well, Zara Baker, she's 10 years old. She was 10 years old. Moved here to the States with her father, Adam Baker, after he married an American woman, Elisa Baker. And they were living in North Carolina. I forget the name of the town that they were living in, but they lived in North Carolina. And the father one day called the 911, reported his daughter missing. And there was a fire or something like that in the backyard, and they called the police for that. And then somewhere along the line, I can't remember exactly where, but there was a ransom note found, and the cops automatically thought that it was that the daughter was kidnapped. Well, come to find out, the stepmother admitted that she wrote the ransom note, and it was strictly to throw them off the case. And so she was arrested for obstruction of justice. And the search went on for Lil Zara. Nobody knew where she was at. Nobody knew what happened. But she went. While they had the stepmother in jail, she decided to cooperate. And I do believe they worked a deal out with her that they wouldn't charge her with first-degree murder, that they decided they agreed on second-degree murder if she would cooperate. And, I mean, I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure
Correct, Dan. Jan, that's what happened.
Yeah, and they've got her. She told them where they could find the body. But the point is, the body had been dismembered, and her parts had been scattered off in different areas in the area that they lived in. And they still, to this day, haven't found all of her body. I don't believe they've even got a skull, but there was no cause of death either. They said the bone parts had cut marks where they could see where she had been cut up. And right now, the stepmother is saying that the father helped her, that he was the one that cut the little girl up, and he helped her dispose of the body. But the police claim that they have no evidence against him, that the only one that they hold responsible is the stepmother. So she's been in jail all this, and this has been going on since October. Well, at the end of September is when they say she died, but I think it was like 2 weeks before they reported her. And they've got Elisa in jail right now too. But this woman has got, since this has happened, they have uncovered so many different things on her. I think she's got a total of 9 felony charges against her now, which includes the second-degree murder and the obstruction of justice, and plus 20 misdemeanor charges also, I mean, ranging from bad checks to communicating threats. And, I mean, she's got federal drug charges on her, too, for trafficking prescription painkillers. And now they're saying that they want to try her for all these felony charges before they try her for the murder, though. because they said that all of it happened before Zyra was killed. And they said that in the state of North Carolina, I guess, they can get her more prison time if she's convicted of the other felonies, if she's convicted of the murder, too. So, but right now they're asking of a change of venue on her case also.
Isn't there also a minor bigamy issue?
Oh, that's one of the other charges, too. She's been married, like Manny said, she's been married several times and didn't bother getting divorces. As a matter of fact, one of her husbands lived across the street from them whenever they moved wherever it was that they were living at. I think she had told Adam Baker that he was her brother or something to that effect. I don't remember exactly how it was. But anyway, they are asking for a change of venue. They have filed a motion for it, and they're going to go to court on August the 1st to hear for that. The DA doesn't think that there's any reason that they should have to move it, but it'll be up to the judge when it all comes down to it. And she's also, for the federal charges, she's got an arraignment hearing set for September 12th for the federal charges. So all this is supposed to come up before the murder charge comes up. So she's got a long line that she's got to go down before she even gets to the murder charge.
So, Jan, let me add a couple facts to that. One of the reasons why Adam Baker wasn't charged is that Eliza claimed that he was with her when she discarded the body, and cell phone records showed that Eliza was in the area where the child was born, but Adam's cell phone records said he wasn't near that, so it debunked her claim. So I don't know that she's just trying to add them. I you know, when you look at this, she was 42 and I think he's 33, and I wonder if he married her to get in the United States and to be able to move here.
I often wondered that too.
Yeah,
I thought about that too.
Yeah, so some of that, but some of the interesting things about I read the motion for change of venue, and you know, he made the usual claims of highly prejudicial, et cetera, and he talked about how the Charlotte Observer published more than 145 articles on the case. There are over 9.5 million Google hits on the case already, and that the Hickory Daily Record, the local paper, were taking voice opinions from everybody, which he feels has contaminated the jury. And by the way, Hickory, which I've driven through, is about 30 to 40 miles west and a little bit north of Charlotte in North Carolina. So if they move the trial to Charlotte, which would be the most likely, he still has to deal with the number of different problems that go with having that many articles done. So I don't see anywhere in North Carolina, considering it's a small state, and there are only a couple of medium-sized cities other than Charlotte, where they could hold this trial. So more than likely, that will be reason enough to decline the motion. But if they're going to transfer it, I think it will go to Charlotte, where they have a much larger jury pool. Because in these cases, as you learned and we all learned from Casey Anthony, the size of the jury pool is very, very important in these kind of cases. And I hope those supplements help you, Simon.
And Denny, I don't know how much you have been following the Zyra Baker story, but how come Zyra Baker didn't get the national press that Casey Anthony did?
Well, I'm not sure her... first of all, she's a little bit older, I think. Casey was, what at the time, 21 or whatever when this thing started?
22, I believe.
22. And I don't think the activity was... I really believe this whole Casey thing was this bizarre activity and the lies to the cops on July 15th when Cindy made the 911 call. The visit to Universal Studios for the non-existent job. And I think Casey was so bizarre in her conduct that it really caught the attention of everybody. That's my belief, and it's going to be tough for someone to come along, even if the crime is similar. or the circumstances are similar about a missing child and so forth, I think it's going to be very tough for the next person to get the publicity and attention unless they do something similar conduct-wise to what Casey Anthony did.
Okay, I'm going to skip right on here to another case. But trust me, Zahra Baker will be talked about on a future program.
Could I just say one final thing, Simon?
Sure.
I think that, like, with Casey and Kaylee, it was just a perfect storm that everything came together, and all of a sudden it took off. You know, there was just something strange, really, really strange about the whole thing with Casey and Kaylee.
Well, I want to add something, too. One of the primary differences is Liza Baker's admitted to killing the child, where Casey didn't. That's number one. And again, where I disagreed with Dave respectfully is that Nancy Grace was a precipitating factor then. In this case, the only thing Nancy Grace has had to say is her disappointment that she wasn't charged with first-degree murder. Of course, Nancy Grace didn't do any homework and determined it because it was because of a deal. So here you have an admitted killer, and the only question is what to do with her. And in the other case, there was a great deal of mystery involved. There's another case that Simon may be getting to in California. This is a high-profile case for a variety of reasons, but you probably haven't heard about it in Florida. So go ahead, Simon.
And Manny, that was exactly where I was leading. You and I talked earlier this week about Lawrence King. It's a horrible story, and I think I would like you to tell it.
Well, it's a horrible story for a great many reasons. One, it signals a problem with our school system, and the other one, it signals a problem basically in our society. At the time, I believe they were 15 years old, a young man named Brandon McNerney, who was now he denies it, was becoming part of a skinhead Nazi group, shot and killed a gay classmate. And he just didn't shoot him. He came into the school with a gun in his pack, sat behind him in class, shot him in the back of the head, looked around the class at everyone else, and then shot him again. And he claims now that he didn't do it because of a hatred of homosexuals. It's because this kid came on to him, Larry King, came on to him at 14 years old, and basically that was his reason. And even the witness in the school say that the day before he was killed, he said, "I love you," to the guy. But it turns out that Larry King is a mentally disturbed young man who sometimes wore high heels and lipsticks to school. And the failure to me in our school system is not only not protecting him or doing anything about it, but putting him among that kind of mix of students where he was in great danger without anything else. You can't take among 14 to 16-year-old boys, especially with the influx of skinheads and a variety of other people, and suddenly throw them out in the middle of the playground any more than you could take a gay person thrown in the middle of a playground in a prison, as Denny will talk about. So what we have here is a gay killing that is less about the gay killing, but more about teenagers taking guns to school and killing other teenagers. I mean, forget about whether he's gay or not. What if he were a member of a rival gang? What if you didn't like his football team? What if you didn't like the fact he was dating your girlfriend? There are a thousand reasons, but to sit in class and cold-bloodedly shoot someone from 6 inches away with a pistol, not once in the head, but after watching him go down, because I think it's fairly obvious to anyone listening that you shoot somebody in the back of the head, they're not going to get up and walk to the hospital, but to shoot him a second time is really an issue. And I know there was a gay student killed in Florida a year or two ago, Dave, and it's becoming a problem. But the problem isn't about gays. The problem is about kids taking guns to school, whether it's Columbine or here, and acting out their right-wing or Nazi or hate crime or whatever it is within the school system. And that's what that case is about. Trial's going on, and hopefully we're going to cover more of it. Go ahead, Simon.
Denny, yes. I know that you probably know very little about this case, but you must be listening to this in shock and horror.
Well, Yes. However, there have been enough incidents, and I think Manny very correctly pointed out, there are all kinds of reasons, apparently, for this type of violence that goes on in these schools. And I got to tell you, when I first became shocked, of course, obviously Columbine was a real eye-opener, but when I started hearing and reading in the newspapers and stuff about the security at some of the schools, I mean, metal detectors and armed guards and sometimes privately hired or sometimes police personnel and whatever. And I'm thinking, my God, when I was in school, our big thing was, to try to sneak somewhere for a smoke when we were 14 or 15 years old without getting caught and getting sent to the principal's office. Now we got people carrying guns and knives and so forth coming in, and they're looking to intimidate people and actually do bodily harm or kill people. And I'm thinking, where are we as a society here going? I mean, it's just very scary. And whatever the reason is, be it a hate crime, be it sometimes gang rivalry, or even as Manny pointed, maybe a sports thing. It doesn't matter. The point is, where in the hell have we gone so far wrong that people think it's permissible? And this conduct is, how did we get to this point? That bothers me.
Dave, this story obviously is way out of Orlando. But, I mean, you've listened to it. I you must be just shocked.
Yeah, well, murder is murder, and that should shock everybody. But in this case, I think it's a hate crime. I mean, the guy didn't like that the kid was flamboyant, and maybe the kid did try and hit on him. But, I think everybody's had their fair share of bullies one way or another. But that doesn't mean that you should be able to pick up a gun and shoot him for it. I mean, I hope this kid gets punished, just whatever the law allows. Just because you don't murder people, you just don't do it like that.
Right.
There's no
excuse
for it.
I'm bullied. I'm bullied by my wife.
No, I'm not.
Well, we all know about internet bullies, I'm sure, that, but would I really, really wish him any harm? No, I wouldn't. So, because I just turned the other cheek, and I don't mean that like I'm better than anyone else. It's just that I guess maybe that has to do with age, too. If I was a 17-year-old kid in high school and very macho and some gay kid kept coming after me, no, I wouldn't like it. And, there's all that peer pressure, all that, this kid feels, shame or whatever, like this guy's trying to make me look gay or whatever. And so maybe it's a different mindset, I guess, when you're young. When I was young, I remember when I worked for a fast food restaurant, and I used to have to take the rugs out at night to shake them out, the dirt outside of the front doors. And these two guys, I didn't really know anything about what gay people were. This guy asked me if I'd like to come to his house and pose naked, that he'd take pictures. I was scared to death. And I ran inside, and I told my boss and the other guy who was working there, and they were laughing like crazy, But it was intimidating, and they said, don't worry, Dave, we wouldn't let anything happen to you. But they knew, obviously, that these two guys were gay, but I didn't.
Okay, but I don't believe that is really the story here. Many, as I understand it, the gay kid had a bit of a mental problem, a disability, shall we say.
Yeah, he was definitely mentally disabled, and everybody knew it. That's what bothered me about it, is he basically elected to kill a mentally disturbed young man. And I consider that just awful. So, yes, maybe... And by the way, from what was said in the testimony and what I read at the time, it wasn't that he came on to him as much as he was just a mentally ill kid who acted like this and may or may not have meant it, but, you know, it's very easy to look at somebody that ill and just go, and by the way, they had classes together, so he knew, and, you know, for him to just go, you know, the kid's mentally ill, because I'm sure everyone else laughed it off, too. And what was interesting to me is I watched his teacher on the air the other day when she was being interviewed and asked if she had any inner reaction. She commented that a day or so before the case was heard, before the killing, she actually pulled this Brandon McInerney into her office to talk to him because his father came in and lamented that
Hang on one second. Yeah. We're about to lose our live listeners, but listeners, fear not. It is all being recorded.
So coming back, he basically, she asked him, so you're a leader in this class. Where do you want to take this class in your life? And this the kid, Brandon McInerney, who killed him, said, I would take them a place they don't want to be. So he was already showing an attitude problem and was already exhibiting some pretty dangerous testimonies from what I can see. And what bothers me is the school board either doesn't want to or feels inadequate in terms of eliminating these students. And even in the case of the child, Lawrence King, or Larry King as we call him here in L.A., because it's humorous to all of us, because we all, you know, it allows us to have a little fun with Larry King, the entertainer, is that basically he shouldn't be in that school. He shouldn't be in that group, not because someone's against gays, but because it's not our school system's function to have students that require protection. And he's a student that requires some type of active effort and protection, and that's not really what our schools are designed to do. They're not staffed enough in California, as many people know, like other places. The school system's going down the proverbial toilet for a lack of funding and money. So, gee whiz, you know, now you can add the burden of having to guard special interests or special needs children to an already overburdened cost. In fact, the gay coalition that tries to help with these issues ceased to get funding from the state because of our budget crisis, and they're closing up doors next week. So even the safeguard units who could have counseled him and done something with the situation could not do it because they didn't have the funding to be on site. And that's so we have this problem going everywhere in our country.
The major issue I have is with the education system as a whole. I'm going to go back to, I think, 1988. I moved to San Diego, wife, two young children, and we had to get them signed up for school. And it was only about two blocks from home. Yeah, so, I mean, just literally around the corner. And my ex-wife and I went in there to go through the sign-up process, and my ex-wife asked the question, what about lunch? Do they get to come home? Because, you know, they're used to coming home for lunch. This lady looked at her fairly seriously, then cracked a smile and said, oh my goodness, no, if we let them out at lunchtime, half of them wouldn't come back.
Welcome to our school system.
Yeah.
But, you know, you get what you pay for in this world. And we used to have a joke when I was in law school during the Vietnam War. The more money was spent in Vietnam in one day than in our entire judicial system for a year. So if that's going to be the case, well, take a look at what we spend on our educational system compared to what we spend on defense and a million other things. And then I look at all these companies talk about the brain drain when they're not doing anything to educate the masses. And so in the fact that all the advantaged children go to private schools, at least the public schools, looking just terrible because the best students don't even go there. So part of this is what used to be known as white flight in California versus the fact that since these are minority schools, primarily in minority sections. Nobody wants to fund them. Nobody wants to give them additional money. So if I'm spending $10,000 a year to send my child to private school, why would I want to or increase my taxes to support minority children in the ghetto when I'm paying top dollar to educate my children? And that is becoming a major problem throughout our country and is a major problem here in California. So we need to deal with that as a country.
Denny, do you have any thoughts on education?
Yeah, education, it reminds me, Simon, we don't have, I think, in most cases anyway, the ability or the setup to handle these situations, and with budget cuts and this and that. I know even when I was doing police work, we used to have people on the streets, you know, that had issues, mental health issues, and they really didn't have to be institutionalized, and yet they shouldn't have been out on the street either, because they were easy victims, and now they would also get into trouble. And I remember it got so bad because there was no place to put these people. And if we got a call for a trespass or a suspicious person, it turned out to be one of these people that had more or less fallen through the cracks. We didn't know what to do with them, and we'd pick them up, put them in our car, and take them across the county line into the next county and drop them off and let the next county do with it. And one night I ran into one of the other county's cars. He was delivering a package to us. I mean, that's the way it was, because there was no way to deal with these people. It's really a sad situation.
Yes, it is. And that is common.
Oh, man.
Yeah. And, you know, it really is. It's very, very common. And for those of us here, when we see these issues with schools, for example, this Leave No Child Behind, well, it leaves everybody behind. I know, Simon, this is a tough subject for you because you're really upset by it too. But invariably, that applies only to minorities. So when you hear about how poorly they're testing in the schools, et cetera, we're talking about our lowest common denominator students in the poorest schools receiving the poorest education, and they're being tested, and those statistics are being used to make arguments about what's going on in terms of education. But they don't go to their schools. Like in my neighborhood, there's one called Harvard Westlake that turns out kids who go directly to Harvard, Berkeley, you name it, anywhere in the country, and scores on the top of every test it ever takes, but they're not in the statistics because they're a privately funded school. So what's happening here is that the statistics are skewed. They're so skewed that it's very difficult to understand what our real problem is. And I don't know if
no
you have
No Child
problem
Left
where you are.
Behind is a really, really badly named initiative. It should be No Child Allowed to Get Ahead.
I agree. Really, it is really one of the worst programs I have ever seen. And every time I hear anyone from the Bush group talk about this, I just want to reach through the TV and grab them by the throat for the destruction they've done to our country. You know, one of the problems in this country that we have to deal with is our desire to separate the disadvantaged from the advantaged and then treat them differently. It leads to revolution. It leads to all sorts of other problems. But what it's leading to, and what is the worst part about all this, is what I call the brain drain. Invariably, what we have here is people losing education, people not being able to progress, not contributing to our country. So in my generation, minorities got somewhat of an education, and you look around, you have minority doctors everywhere. You have minority lawyers, psychiatrists, everything. But in the future, those professions will resume their formerly white statistics, because minorities will not be able to afford to be educated in those arenas. And that is a very, very sad situation in the United States right now.
All right. And I think on this note, I'm going to wrap the program up before I absolutely lose it and get on my soapbox. I want to go around the table and get everyone's parting thoughts, and also ask you if you'd be happy to take part next week We're going to do a similar program. We're going to talk about murder, grim murder. Many.
Well, I guess I will join you next week because there's nothing better on a Sunday afternoon than a murder club. And some people actually pay to go there. So our listeners get to listen to those for free.
Denny.
Yes. I will.
Your words of wisdom for us.
Well, I think, Simon, I want to compliment you on the idea of continuing a show, you know, even after the Anthony trial ended, because there are so many cases out there that are very interesting and cases that sometimes can be shocking and that we can learn a lot from, but they don't get the publicity. Not every case reaches the proportions of a Casey Anthony or an O.J. Simpson. And a lot of these things fall through the cracks. You know, there might be local news, but that's as far as it goes. And I think anything to help get the word out about some of these other cases, and there are a lot of victims out there that you know, deserve mention just as much as Kaylee did. And I think this is a good move on your part.
And Dave?
Well, I'm glad that we have kind of like evolved into something else and that we're going to continue it. And you know, unless something comes up, I plan on being here. So thank you.
And Jen?
Well, I guess I'm not going anywhere. I'll be here.
You should think about that, Jan.
He won't let me get out of it.
I know.
I mean, where would you go? I mean, you could fly to L.A. and stay with Manny, but you'd have to be sharing a room with Casey Anthony.
Oh no, no thank you.
I promise you, you'd get some world-class tomatoes.
Now that might bring me out there.
I know.
Okay. Till next week, this is Simon and Jen Barrett wishing everyone a happy, healthy, and safe day. Till next time, goodbye.
Thank you all for being here.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.